where I talked about positivism. And in your comment on my paper, which was about the same thing, I'm trying to find a quote here. You mentioned that, you know, I gave a sort of a traditional definition of metaphysics.
Yes.
And you said that Whitehead sort of went beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And then what, my two questions are, generally speaking and simply, how did he do that? And secondly, is there some place in one of the books that we...
Yes. Okay, so first of all, the place is chapter one of Process and Reality.
Okay.
And the... The older ideas of metaphysics, there are different, of course, definitions of metaphysics that happen all the time, but in general, in the older days, in more of the efficient mental time, there was the sense that reason is a faculty given to humankind by the same whatever it is that creates the universe. And so that our thinking, in this old way of looking at it, is held to simply, if we do it well, our thoughts correspond to the way reality is. Right? And the big example that really opens this up is the Euclidean geometry, which it was assumed that geometry was the actual structure of actual space. So metaphysics in those days would start with ideas that were held to be self-evident to reason. And if an idea was self-evident to reason, that was considered a sufficient warrant for its truth. So here's an example. We take some entity, some ousia, like the cup, and we analyze it, and we come up with all these different formal factors, like round and green and so forth. But then our minds say, well, there must be something in which those qualities inhere. And from a certain point of view, that just seems so obvious that nobody could even think about how to argue with it. And so for 2,000 years, that was taken as something true about reality, that reality is substantial because we were thinking about it using the idea of substance. And that had become so habitual that nobody could think of anything else. So they just assumed it was true. And the general principle is that if you've heard an idea all your life and never been introduced to an alternative idea, that idea will come to seem so obvious that it's unquestionable. So the old metaphysics would start with ideas that seemed unquestionable. You know, God's goodness, the reality of substance, the hierarchical categories of nature. These just seemed so obvious that nobody would question them. So they were... Philosophers would set these up and then try to deduce reality from that. And so in the old style of metaphysics, it was essentially based on this notion of the ability of reason to penetrate into the nature of reality unaided. Right? And so the old metaphysicians would set up ideas and then deduce from there. Then in the modern world, that becomes impossible because we begin to realize that many of the ideas we have, for example, substance or three-dimensional space, don't apply to the actual world. And so we can no longer simply reach into reason to find ideas and argue from them. And this change really becomes apparent with Kant. Kant's the guy who really, in his life, he experiences this transition and works it out. Quite remarkable ways. But so with Kant, we get this idea of critical thought, critical thinking, in which rather than looking at whether or not these ideas are really true of the outer world, the question becomes, how do ideas function in the assembly of knowledge? Right? So for example, Kant, you know, the naive interpretation of Newton. Hi, welcome. You visiting our class? A possible PCC student?
I'm a possible student.
And what's your name?
Janet.
Everybody, welcome, Janet. So we get this idea at Kant that the ideas are generated by human beings
And then human beings, having generated the ideas, use them to open up a peculiar sort of sadomasochistic dialogue with nature, in which our ideas become the rack on which we stretch nature to get her to reveal her truths. Right? But the idea here is that the ideas come from inside, that the ideas are an effect-free creation. This is Kant's idea, that we then use as sort of a filter through which to interact with the world, and that's how we generate knowledge. But Whitehead takes it one step further, and Whitehead, but it's very similar in some way, but Whitehead says that metaphysics is the critique of abstractions. Right? So that metaphysicians, for Whitehead, look at all the different ways in which people explain things, the different sorts of explanatory moves, and the different sorts of basic ideas through which people are approaching different domains of nature, and raises a critical awareness of them. Okay, so mathematical physics is approaching nature through models based on mathematical relations. And psychology is approaching nature based on the ideas of purpose and will and the conscious and the unconscious and so forth. So we have these different bodies of ideas through which we're approaching nature and ourselves. And the metaphysician looks at each one of these ideas and says, how well does it work? And how far can it be generalized? Right? And so a metaphysician is someone who looks at all the different forms of knowledge and tries to construct an embracing form which can be generalized over all the others. Right? So the metaphysics becomes an aim at generality of insight. That makes sense? Okay, that answer your question?
Yeah.
And the Locus Classicus is the very first chapter of Process and Reality, in which Whitehead clearly and elegantly and briefly outlines his ideal of the metaphysical task. There's also really good stuff on that in Modes of Thought and scattered elsewhere, but that's the locus classicus for that particular idea. Okay. Yeah. Any other general questions?
I have one.
Yes, please, Michael.
In Whitehead's system, what's the ontological difference between the higher and lower grade? I'm sure you explained
it. Yes, there's none.
Before, but it's,
there's none. There's no ontological difference. That's the whole point. The whole point is that Whitehead says that the ideal of metaphysical cosmology is to account for everything in terms of one type of entity. And that entity for Whitehead is actual occasions. And so the grades, the difference in grades have no ontological significance. However, as you'll see as we get into further chapters, I'm at pains to argue for the ontological independence of higher grade occasions vis-a-vis lower grade occasions. Right. So in waking life, all the higher grade occasions that we interact with are embodied in physical bodies. And so we then have this idea that all higher level functioning depends on the physical level. And I'm at pains to say no, that the higher grade occasions can exist on their own and under proper circumstances can become embodied in the physical world, but they're not ontologically dependent on it. But other than that, sort of a generally superior ontological status for higher grade occasions, it's minor. They're all the same type of entity. Does that answer the question? Is it?
Yes.
Okay.
Would there be non-physical occasions?
Yes, absolutely.
And that's how, so...
That's transphysical worlds are non-physical occasions.
So reality exists in the physical and the transphysical.
Exactly.
And reality are the occasions that are...
That's exactly it. That's the fundamental move.
So then physical occasions would be an outspring from transphysical occasions.
Yes. Exactly, I would say it's an involution in some way.
Yeah, that would be...
That the lower grade occasions emerge out of the higher grade occasions through a process of self-limitation.
Yeah, I think that's what the physical world is. It's no.
Well, it's a limitation.
We're
right on, yes.
Which is what logic is a type of limitation. You limit relationships, you limit how things can interact.
Yeah, logic is a type of limitation. That is always true, but I wouldn't want to associate that particularly with the physical.
No. That would be a transphysical.
There's a logic at every level, right?
But logic isn't an occasion. It's the rules of occasions.
Yes, exactly. It's the structure of the eternal objects, the realm of the eternal objects, and it is not actual occasions. Exactly. Excellent. Okay. Anything else? Good. Okay. So, what have you guys got for us?
I'm so excited.
It's not a presentation.
That's okay. It's just a sharing of what you did in the study group to stimulate our larger conversation.
Sure. Well, it started because I've always been fascinated by the limbic system. The limbic system and the idea that, you know, babies need the limbic systems in order to entrain with their mothers. It's through their limbic systems.
What is the limbic system? Oh, sorry.
That's fine. It's so funny because I'm wanting to explain it and I'm like, well, in theory, there are these three types of brains, and there's the reptilian brain, which is like the brain stem that functions as are the basics of how our body works. So our breathing, it runs our breathing, it runs our heart beating, so we don't have to think about it. It also is like the instinctual thing. It's where sex, urges for sex. So basically very, I guess what they'd say, reptilian, animalistic parts of our being. Mm-hmm. And then there's the limbic system, which is the mammalian part of the brain, which is emotions, feeling, where they say love resides. And then finally there's the neocortex, which is the part that distinguishes us from all other animals, being the gray part of our brain that surrounds everything else, where, you know, cognitive process and all that thing, all of those processes. So I was fascinated by the limbic system and this emotional center of our being, where they say love happens, where we entrain with other people, and this is the process they say when birds are flying, when they start flying the same direction, it's because they have limbic systems, and they're one of the only non-mammals to actually have that part of the brain. So anyway, I was so fascinated by the neuroscience of what love could mean according to what the limbic system represents and all these things. So I wanted to bring this into how do we talk about process philosophy and our biology and finding that bridge between the two places.
Excellent.
So I was going to do a presentation, The Cosmology of Love, just on neuroscience of love and how, you know, I feel like it's this illusion of hormones and all these things. Then I realized, well, what's more fascinating is to bring it into process philosophy. So I saw Linda and Madeline after class with me, and I was like, help, I'm doing this topic, I have no idea what I'm doing. I know I want to talk about it, but I don't know how to do this. I know nothing about Whitehead at this point, and I just feel really not sure of how to do this. So I mentioned it to them, and they suggested maybe I mention it to Richard to talk about at the study group. So that's how it all started. And what I think we began talking about in the study group was, so an example would be, Richard, you brought this great example of smelling someone. And so when you smell someone, you suddenly, you know, your pheromones or all these hormones start raging, and it's through that basic lower grade process that then entrains and creates, it's like so what happens is your brain creates this emotion, and then the rest of your body decides, do I want to be a part of this, or do I not? And so what happens is then you choose in this hierarchy that a lower grade occasion can actually create this higher grade occasion.
Wait, I lost that. Create?
Like trigger, I guess maybe might.
Okay.
Proposition. That's a good word. That's what we're using. So a lower grade occasion can like proposition a higher grade occasion.
That's not how I'm using the word, but go ahead.
Okay. So in this instance, it would be, so the pheromones created this reaction in the brain, and then maybe the heart decides, do I want to be a part of this? Like, am I wanting to experience love, an emotion of love, or am I going to keep it at this level of lust or whatever else? And so in that way, it feels like our body acts as like this gateway into something else. So we experience love. We decide we want to experience romantic love. Romantic love could then be a gateway into something higher, like the higher purpose of love or whatever definition you want to use for that. And then love being another gateway into the divine and something larger. So thinking of the body and biology more of like a gateway into an experience than it being something separate from the process of philosophy.
So love is
heart of the philosophical process, you're saying?
Correct.
Right.
In this way, a gateway into the creativity.
Well, that's really beautiful.
So I don't know if I said that.
You said that very well. Anybody want to comment on that? I mean, I have things to say about it, but it's a beautiful idea and really interesting. So what the rest of you have to say about that? Huh? Well, I think you're asking, yeah.
Let's see. I was thinking, and also when you talk about feeling and so forth, thinking about the connection to consciousness always. And so, my work and my view is that certain brain areas support consciousness as a. As a higher grade occasion, and everything passes through that. And something like insular cortex, way inside the brain, is like a retina for all your inner states, feelings, you know, need for food, stuff like that, anything. So, feeling is intimately bound up with consciousness for me, and it's supported, like you're saying, the gateway stuff is beautiful, yeah, I think that's great.
Well, let me say a couple things about this, because
I'm not sure how my point of view exactly intersects, because I'm just trying to say that,
Should we finish our presentation?
Do you want me to comment or do you want to go ahead?
Well, it's kind of, I mean, it's the same thing we were just going to say in different ways, so maybe I'm bringing it
great.
To put that also more into just the terms of process philosophy.
Yes.
And we were looking first at just, you know, like a person and the lower, all the different grade occasions within the physical body presided over by the higher grade transphysical personality. And then it kind of got bigger and bigger until it felt like there was just this one concrescence of the Godhead at the very top, and the aim of the Godhead would then filter down to all the other aims of the occasions involved. But what's the thing that came out that brought it back to the original question was that any of the lower grade occasions have their own aim and they have their own potential to be creative in their aim.
That's right.
And so that's what we're trying, so it's serving as a lure for feeling.
What's a lure for feeling?
The lower grade occasions, as I understand it from your chapter, are propositions
No, lower grade occasion is never a proposition. Not in another one. It's an element in a proposition in another occasion, but it is not a proposition.
Okay, so a proposition is okay.
We'll get to that.
Right. Yeah. In any case, it just became this beautiful hierarchy where the aims are all united, yet there's that creativity coming from below.
That's right.
And so all the different parts of the brain fit into that. In fact, when you talked about the three parts of the brain, which you didn't mention in the discussion group, the way you described them corresponded exactly to how you described the sensory, the empathetic, and the telepathic.
That's right. That's right.
You used the same words practically.
Yeah.
That's right.
So that was kind of interesting.
Wow.
That's beautiful, right? So you guys are totally on the right track and asking all the right questions. This is fantastic. I have a couple of technical points to contribute just to facilitate the work that you're doing, because I love it, right? So one point, and do I have a pen I can borrow?
Sorry.
So let me just pop something down here so it's a language. I got a couple things I want to say. So the first one is about language and about philosophy. And Bill, this is also particularly addressed to you as well. I've been talking to you about how to do philosophy, or the way Kassira would say it. I've been talking to you about the form of philosophical knowledge. Right? What Kassira is teaching me is that every form of knowledge, every kind of knowledge, has a particular form into which it has to be placed, right? And so what I'm learning is that metaphysical knowledge or philosophical knowledge is formed by setting up a certain beginning language, with a certain language that begins it. And this language, as Whitehead says,
consists of tentative articulations of the ultimate generalities of experience. Love that phrase. Tentative articulations of the ultimate generalities of experience. In other words, what's always true of every experience? What is the form of experience itself? Right? So then we come up with some ideas about the form of experience. Right? So for Whitehead, we get creativity, God, eternal objects, actual occasions, and everything that follows from that. Right? So then, once you have that set up, the objective is to tell the entire story in that language. Now, what's happening to a number of you, which is creative and great, right, is that you're getting the Whiteheadian language, and it's really stimulating because it opens up all these thought possibilities. But then you also have these other languages that you're comfortable speaking. And the trouble is, how do you combine these two languages? So, for example, the question that you're raising, Becky, is what does a process analysis of neuroscience look like? Right? Now, in your speaking, you made a lot of interesting moves that were semi-conscious. For example, at one point you talked about the brain generates a thought. Right? That's clearly scientific thinking in a certain way, right? But I'm fascinated by the form of that. So I have an experience in which I see something and it evokes an empathic response. Okay, so that's just an experience that I've had, right? Then I said, oh, okay, well, out there's a brain. And in that brain, when I had this experience, that thing happened out there in the brain box. Right? And so then we have this odd thing where we have experience over here and this external separate entity over there. And we're sort of making this crude mapping. Oh, this new region of my brain is the retina for all the rest, right? So then I have a sixth consciousness, what the Buddhists call a sixth consciousness. And my sixth consciousness is my capacity to register the data from all the senses. Right? So there it is. So you're pointing to something really important. But can we map that onto some region of the brain? And what does that actually mean? Right? So this is a really important question. What is the mapping between our experience and our model? Right? And the problem with the neuroscientific models is that they tend to treat the brain as if it's a classical system. In fact, most brain scientists won't even acknowledge the relevance of quantum theory because it's too upsetting. They just want the brain to be this chemical box that does things, and they want to make these arbitrary mappings with no understanding of how the mapping works or why, right? And so this is problematical. And you've entered in now into one of the most crucial scientific tasks, right? And I'm talking to some brain scientists about this, right? It's like, how do we rethink neurophysiology on the basis of process work, right? And that's not clear. Yeah, that's a big task that awaits doing. But one contribution I want to make to that is that the general assumption is that the brain is the locus of experience. Right? And so the idea, I mean, we could, for example, play with that and say, well, maybe the limbic system has a higher concentration of medium-grade occasions or something like that. That'd be one way of trying to sort of play with this. Right? But what I'm trying to say is that the higher grade occasions are not part of the physical world, right? And so the mind vastly overflows the brain. And so this kind of theory, which a lot of people other than me are talking about, it's called the filter theory. So the brain becomes conceptualized not as a generator of experience, but rather as a receiver and transmitter that brings in stuff from a higher, brings in stuff from the mental plane and translates it into waking terms, and vice versa. Right? And so then the brain doesn't generate necessarily much of anything in terms of personality. Right? So this is another angle I want you to keep in mind as you work to reformulate neuroscience on process lines. Right? But the task you picked up, see, is really necessary. I mean, it's right at the forefront of integral development. Is this task of reformulating neurophysiology along process lines. Any contribution you can make, even to clarifying the question, will be welcome. Because it's even right there. Yeah?
Yeah, it's a place because I'm so embedded in it that it's very hard for me to maybe jump into the process philosophy, which I would like to do. But it seems like, just in thinking of the garbled stuff that I said there,
in his paper.
I'm missing that consciousness is everywhere, it's in all levels of the occasions, and so it's very hard for me. I have the box out here, and this does this, and well, this would be an occasion of some sort, but I don't really know how to get those, you know, scintillating aware feeling networks.
Well, the way you
that would make up everything from the molecular interactions to the non-cellular level.
Well, here's the text. You see, the problem is that all of our scientific theories are formulated in the context of an implicit and taken for granted ontology.
Right.
And so the assumption is that we can look at the outer world in abstraction from the fact that it's always perceived. Right? So we can ignore the fact, we can ignore empiricism and pretend that the things in the world exist without being observed and therefore that they're capable of generating experience. And this can't be true, because if the things in the world existed outside of their being experienced, then they can never be experienced at all, because being experienceable wouldn't be part of their nature. Right? And so the problem here is that there's this habit. The whole thing is habit. Right? And the habit is the habit of naive realism. Right? It's the habit of thinking there's some reality out there which has the characteristics that we perceive, even if we're not perceiving it, which is actually not true, as scientists will tell us. Right? And so then we assume there's this stuff out there that exists before we do, and then we try to explain everything on the basis of this hypothesized stuff. But then if we look into it, we can't find that stuff anywhere. It isn't there. Right? This is what process theory tells us. There is no substance. Right? And that for something to be real means it has the power to be experienced by other occasions. And that's what its reality amounts to. Not its independent existence, but in fact its relational existence. Is its only guarantee of objectivity, right?
So occasions feel each other sort of on the same grade level.
Yeah.
What do higher grade occasions? They definitely get influenced by lower grade.
They higher grade occasions do experience lower grade occasions clearly. The way we experience higher grade occasions, that's a little more pressure. They experience us, but we experience them in sort of indirect sort of ways. We can't objectify them in the same way we can objectify lower grade occasions.
Right.
But the point is this. The point, Bill, is this. Is that any time you find yourself making a scientific statement, like the brain generates a thought, you need to translate that right then and there. What does that mean in process language? What are we saying in the language of actual occasions, right? Or if we talk about, you know, some of the stuff you're talking about with more complex, higher grade quanta and so forth, right? How do we translate that into process language? Because the point is that philosophical understanding, the form of philosophical understanding, is the translation of our insights into a consistent language. Right? Just like all the sciences can cooperate with each other, sort of, because they're all putting in a mathematical language, right? So there's some sort of commensurability, even though in science gotten very thin these days, right? But the whole ideal of metaphysical thought is consilience. And so we need to be able to think through all the areas of our experience using a common language. And so the question then becomes, in order to get from process theory to physics, you have to add some definitions, probably, right? But what are they, right? So you start out with the idea of the subatomic events as actual occasions, and then spell out the physics in that language and see what happens. Right? So you have to ground yourself in a single language and translate your other insights into that language if you want to have a philosophical understanding of it. Right? You see how that works?
I think so. And the Whitehead plus expanded Whitehead point of view is a self-consistent framework. So if you can translate things into that language, then you have access to a lot of way liberated, broader ways of thinking.
Well, exactly. For example, if you translate physics into the language of actual occasions, you built subjectivity into physics, and you built purpose into physics, and you built love into physics, right? So you haven't lost anything, because the mathematical description is still there as an abstraction that's valid, but now you know what you're abstracting from, and now you can define the mathematical reduction in process terms. Right? And so the whole thing opens up in a way that's coherent with our own experience. The mind-body problem disappears in using this one language which resolves that problem all the way through. Right? So you can talk about quantum psychology as well as quantum physics if we use process language. And we can analyze them separately using different methods, but still we see how they fit together.
So if you do something like explaining Whitehead's causality using something like the implicate order quantum idea.
Say that again, I got scratched.
I can't really make sense of Whitehead's notions of causality. I don't understand enough yet, for one. But if you, if you use science to expand Whitehead, or use science to accomplish the same philosophic things that Whitehead does with a certain formulation that doesn't do violence to the consistency of the system. I mean, is that legal?
No, it's not. It's interesting. Now, let me put it this way. When you try to translate quantum theory into process language, you may discover you can't do it. You may discover that there are certain connections that are revealed in quantum theory that Whitehead is not adequate to. Right? At that point, you either have to give up on Whitehead or reformulate Whitehead.
Yeah.
But you can't use the quantum language to explain Whitehead, because the quantum language is not a metaphysical language. Right? There really is no metaphysics.
That's where I get trouble, because they're all systems of ideas outside of the habit of thinking them as psychological real. So, what's the problem? They're all ideas. If you get, these ideas to mesh in a way that's consistent, you're in business, whichever angle you come at.
Frameworks of ideas are not equal in their profundity or their penetration into the unity and actuality of the universe. Right? And so, for example, you take Newton, and he's got a cosmological model.
Are you sure I got you? You said frameworks versus ideas?
Frameworks of ideas. Frameworks of ideas are not all equivalent. Right? Right? So for example, in quantum, in Newtonian theory, right, the existence of atoms is simply referred to God. But then everybody forgets about that. So atoms are taken as just simply self-existing. In quantum theory embodies no notion of why a collapse happens.
Right.
The formalism of quantum theory simply tells about the relationship between two successive collapses. It says nothing about the collapse itself, right? Which means that it's a very highly abstract language which doesn't ask the fundamental questions about reality. It makes certain observations and proposes a system of connections between them. But it doesn't ask fundamental questions about the nature of the actual world, about the relationship between matter and consciousness, about the relationship between possibility and actuality, and all these fundamental ideas, right? It doesn't do that. It takes some of those ideas for granted and then generates explanations for very narrow phenomena.
For predictive purposes.
Right? Now, then the question is, how do we generalize quantum theory to cover more of the world?
Yes.
That's what Whitehead's doing. Right, but you've got to step back and say, okay, what is my basic model of actuality, and then fit quantum theory into that. Now you can be inspired. Whitehead's theory is in a certain way a generalization of quantum theory, so it's very much inspired by quantum thought, right?
But he doesn't generalize everything. I don't know that he knew about normal locality.
Well, exactly, right, and so you might turn out Now, here's the first question. You see, Whitehead does have resources for dealing with non-locality in his system. I pointed out some of those.
Right.
Now, they may or may not be adequate to the expression of the quantum mechanical knowledge. But then our task is, if it is adequate, we're done. And if not, we either have to revise Whitehead or come up with a different philosopher. Right? But we have to stick with one language, right? And my claim is that the Whiteheadian metaphysical language is deeper and more comprehensive than the science, because Whitehead's language is designed to describe everything, and quantum theory is designed to account for the results of certain kinds of experiments.
And it's put off to this micro world does not exist on our level.
Exactly, right? So so the question is, how does quantum, we need a general theory of the actual world in the context of which we can express quantum theory. And I think Whitehead gives that to us. Now, certainly it may require, like I had to rethink some of Whitehead's really deep ideas in order to make it adequate to the transphysical worlds. You may need to rethink some of the ideas to make it adequate to quantum theory. And that'd be fantastic, right? But the point is, you've got to ground yourself in a philosophical language and account for the science from there.
Okay.
Right? Because the science is the scientific theories are responsive to more specialized interests.
Right, right.
And have been distorted by that. Does it make sense to everybody what I'm saying? Because it relates to what you're saying, too.
Yeah.
It's an important methodological point.
Well, and that's why science and philosophy need to come together again.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. Science has to recognize that it is necessarily grounded in metaphysics.
The meta part of physics.
Meta,
the umbrella.
That's right.
It holds, and if your meta's not big enough,
that's right.
The bigger meta to hold everything in.
Exactly.
But you should be able to simulate, say, self-organizing systems or quantum system or any piece of science using Whitehead, right? You should be able to do it in process language.
That's the whole bit. And if you can't do that, then maybe there's something wrong with process language, which is fine because it's a constant, it's a work in process.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
Yes?
Well, I just wanted to go back to what I think Becky's been saying, what she was talking about before, because 2 years ago I seemed to be exactly at that spot, trying to get science and Whitehead to trade baseball cards. And I had a lot of trouble doing it, and so I abandoned it because I really didn't need it for my work.
Right.
And so I kind of left Whitehead and went my own way.
Yeah.
But as I got closer to the end of my work, I think I found some language and some different things in science that might help with what you were speaking about, and that it's not the limbic system on its own that does emotions, because there's a heart brain. 2/3 of the cells in the heart are neurons that make the brain operate on its own. The emotive activity is routed through there, first through the vagus nerve.
Yeah, but again, now you're talking science language.
No, I am, but it's a field effect. And it's the field effect. That's where I think you have to go.
And
to
the question,
get Whitehead in it.
And the question is, how would Whitehead deal with field effects?
Yes, that's it.
That's
and
a
I think that gets you closer to a possibility of bringing him there.
Wouldn't that be prehension?
I'm not sure.
It's in your chapter that the aim is influenced not only by space-time proximity, but also by the resonance. So we're talking about entrainment and resonance.
That's right.
That's right. The heart entrains the brain. Right. It's the heart that does it this way. And
yeah, but
now it trains other brains.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
Yeah. You mean the heart is
constant? Please, James.
Sorry.
You're bringing in here is a direction I don't want to go.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Because you're bringing in more scientific specifics. You and Becky can talk about that. I see where you're going, right? But what I'm trying to bring attention to the methodological issue, right? That, I really want to keep attention there, because that's what's important in this conversation, is the method. You have some interesting observations to make, but they're not what I want to really focus our attention. Yeah.
So based on last semester studying process philosophy, and up until about a week ago, I kept thinking that somehow lower grade occasions got together to create higher grade occasions. But now I'm thinking that you actually start with high grade occasions in the spiritual world, and they start to become limited. And as they limit, they actually fall down into lower grade occasions.
Exactly. Now that's the approach I like. It's an involutionary approach. And so I basically used Whitehead to translate the involution into a more scientific language.
And then
but hold on. So I just want to make, but it's really interesting because You know, a lot of people hate the idea of the transphysical worlds. And so I found a way to give them an out. And the way that I give them an out is this. I say, look, maybe it's the case that when the right combination of low-grade occasions arises, they create the conditions for the emergence of a higher-grade occasion. And so that way you could sort of imagine the transphysical world as evolving.
Along with.
I don't think that's the best way to do it. I think your way is by far superior, but I just want to mention that there is an alternative for people who aren't going to be that radical. But you're right on, and that's exactly what I want to say.
So I can even see like the Orions as being these limiters, these filters of higher things, and in that sense, lower grade occasions are reductionist. They're reductions
of higher grade occasions.
Of higher grade occasions.
I've worked this out in quite a bit of detail in an article that's on my website, and it's called something like the involution, Schrierbindel on the involution, or something like that.
I looked at that, but there was just a list of an outline. It wasn't the whole article. Maybe I could be wrong.
Take a look again. If not there, let me know, because I've exactly what you're talking about, I've worked out in a great deal of detail.
So
exactly what you're saying.
In that case, is it almost as if the spirit or the transphysical world is waiting for the physical world to evolve, because the more it evolves, the more it can express itself.
That's it. That's Sri Aurobindo's vision, right?
And
there.
His desire is that we get our shit together so that it can express more of itself in time-space.
That's Sri Aurobindo's vision, right there. Beautifully said. And definitely what I'm driving toward. So thank you, Caleb. That's just exactly it. Excellent. Okay, any other questions about this? This has been great. I just want to thank you guys profoundly for your thought in the sex. Thank you, Richard.
Well,
and then for bringing this back to us to discuss. I mean, that's just magnificent.
And if anybody has questions that they want to talk about in the study group, let's do it. Because it was a great conversation. We had 6 or 7 people, people kind of came and went, and we had a really, really great discussion that all of us got a lot out of, that even brought you to the brink of stuff that James has spent years on. So, I mean, it's like, it was really great. So if you have any ideas for it, email me or Linda, and Linda's really been running with this thing too.
We stayed on topic for an hour straight.
All right!
And we had
Isn't
trouble,
that
fun?
We had trouble stopping.
Yeah. Exactly. That's I'm so glad you discovered that. There's nothing like that.
Yeah.
That's great. All right. Okay, so I have something to say about cause. Anybody want to hear that? Is it a good time or something else that I want to say? Okay, so just... I really appreciated the questions you guys asked me last time. And what I realized was that I had not... You see, it's very interesting in terms of how philosophers work. You see this a lot. That a philosopher will come to a certain subject with some particular project in mind, right? So I came into this analysis of causality because I wanted to show that formal and final causes functioned efficiently in a certain way, right? And I was hell-bent on that, but I never really thought about causality in any kind of abstract way. And so when you guys came at me last time, I realized I couldn't really talk about causality, right? So I went home right away and got out the Encyclopedia of Philosophy and read the article on causality, right? And discovered some things that I want to share with you. So one of them is that the idea of causality, while everybody agrees it is central to the mental mutation, nobody really knows what it is. It's a vague concept, and it's been divided up in all kinds of different ways across history. Right? And so, for example, we have the division to the four causes that Aristotle gave us, but there's another division into contributing factor, sufficient cause, and necessary cause, and there are a few others that I forgot, but one of them made a big impression on me, and that is the distinction of causes into imminent and transient. I don't know what this word comes from, transient. I'd like to find something more English, but this really is in the literature. Imminent causality and transient causality. We could say transitive, probably works about as well, but I have to think about it a little more, figure out where this came from. But the difference here is that if we talk in process language, it's really easy. An imminent cause operates within a concrescence. And a transient cause operates among concrescences. Right? That makes sense? That distinction makes sense?
Can you say it again?
An imminent cause functions in the process of concrescence itself, whereas a transient cause functions between actual occasions. Right, so it's sort of a different kind of cause. Of course, there are a lot of different kinds of causes, and the notion's very vague. But this is a distinction I want to introduce because it'll help in clarifying some of the issues that you brought up to me last time. Okay? So, and then I want to talk about the four causes again. And so we'll start with the material. I had this Xerox, but all the machines were busy this morning, so I'll pass this out to you later. The material cause is not a cause in the transient sense at all. Creativity does not operate really between actual occasions. It operates in concrescence. And in a certain sense, creativity is just a statement that there is concrescence. You know, in Whitehead, the status of creativity is very obscure, because on the one hand, he makes it the principle of the ultimate. But on the other hand, he acts as if it's purely abstract, as if it's a pattern that's abstracted from actuality, but doesn't have any actuality of its own. As opposed to Sri Aurobindo's point of view, which creativity is the consciousness force of the divine, and therefore has an eminent actuality beyond the universe. But in any case, the point is that creativity is that by which the many become one and are increased by one, right? It's simply the fact that concrescences keep happening, and that every concrescence has a mental pole and a physical pole. That's what's being said with creativity. Now, why is it called a material cause? You guys were asking that, right? And probably the name should be changed. But if we look at this functionally, in Aristotle, the material cause functions in three ways. It functions to individualize, right? The fact that each individual thing is an individual thing is an attribute of a substantiality. Okay, secondly, it holds together a family of qualities, right? So the substance is that in which the qualities inhere. And thirdly, it endures unchanging through time and through change. So these are the three functions of substance in Aristotle's metaphysics. Does that make sense?
You repeat them just...
Yeah. It individualizes, it holds together the qualities, and it endures unchanging through time. Those are the functions of Aristotle's category of substance. Okay? It's not a cause, anything like an efficient cause. It's a necessary factor or a basic necessity or something, right? So the word cause is used here in a pretty loose way, right? But it is the it is a name for this ongoing process, and we know, have to notice a lot of the confusion we got into last time was because we weren't sufficiently clear about the way creativity functions in the creation of artifacts on the one hand, versus the way it functions in the creation of natural things on the other. Right, so a natural entity would be a cell, or an atom, or a subatomic event, or a human being. These are natural things, as opposed to tables and chairs and buildings and cars, which are artificial things. Right? In the creation of an artificial thing, the substance pre-exists the process of formation. So I'm going to build a house, right? In some sense, the bricks and the wood pre-exist my construction process. And so the construction is an assembly of pre-existing substances, right? Whereas in the case of actualities, the nature of substance is nothing other than the functions that it performs. That's it, right? And so in process theory, substance individualizes, just like it does in Aristotle, right? Because actual occasions are the primary individuals, and they hold together the qualities, just like Aristotle's substance does, right? And so creativity functions to individualize and to hold together qualities. But instead of assembling it into a finite entity with a finite set of qualities, it assembles it into an infinitely complex synthesis of all qualities and all intensities of the past and a set of possibilities for the future. Right? So for Whitehead, each actual occasion is infinitely complex, whereas for Whitehead, each entity was quite simple, just nothing but its own definitions.
Wait, which Whitehead was the...
Aristotle. I said Whitehead instead of Aristotle. Okay. Okay, and by the way, in Aristotle, substance endures unchanging through time. For Whitehead, substance does not do that. Substance is instantaneous, more or less. Every substance is where and when it is, and it's gone or over. But for Whitehead, the function of continuity through time is performed by form rather than by substance. Right? So I hope this clarifies a little bit about material cause.
And you have to we look around, we see these forms that look relatively unchanging.
Correct.
So So that's a lot of very high-speed occasions, and they're all unique, so they can't repeat, and yet something is close enough that it ingresses the same form.
That's right. Even though the event is different, it's ingressing the same form. And a wide variety of events can continue to ingress a common form.
Bingo. Thanks.
Right? And so the form now has the function of continuity as opposed to substance. So this is interesting, partly because it tells you something about metaphysics, right? Like, you know, at different historical times, when you assign different roles to different things, right? Depending on what we're interested in. So I just want to notice that. Okay, so the sense in which the material cause is a cause is an immanent sense. That is, it's the imminent. There's a certain imminent process in concrescence, the form of that process, and creativity is the answer. What is that? Right, where does that come from? It's the answer to that question. Where does the fundamental process of existence, in this case, treated as a cause of existence? Maybe it's not exactly a cause, but we're treating it like a cause because we're being loose, okay? Now, the material cause is entirely immanent. It doesn't function between occasions. It functions in the formation of an occasion. And it's not something that, you know, is intrinsic to the relationships between them in the same way that efficient cause is, right? Efficient cause is exactly an analysis of how one occasion affects another. So how do the decisions that I am making in this moment, once I've made them, they're irrevocable, how do my decisions affect future occasions? That's the efficient cause. And the efficient cause is always transient. Right? It's never imminent. It's always an analysis of relations between actual occasions. In particular, an analysis of what my irrevocable decisions now, what impact do they have on the future? Answering that question is the analysis of efficient causes. Yeah?
So if a brick can hold a certain amount of weight, and the house can hold as much weight as all its bricks are together, it's the quality of the strength of a brick is efficient with all the bricks to the quality of the strength of the whole house?
That's right. That's right. But also, yeah, and of course each brick exercises pressure on the one below it and stabilizes the ones next to it. So all these causal interactions, they're all efficient causes.
But you would input as the house as an occasion is more...
House is not an occasion.
Oh, so the house is an occasion, it's an...
It's a system, it's a thing, it's an entity, but it's not an occasion because... unless you want to get really mystical about it and say the house has its own presiding actual occasion in the transphysical worlds, but generally speaking, my assumption is that the house is a collection of bricks, and the bricks are collections of atoms, but the atoms are actual occasions. Right? So for me, an actual occasion is self-organizing. Nothing that's not self-organizing is an occasion. It's an assembly or a system of occasions, but not itself an occasion.
Externally related, but not internally related.
That's right. Right. Now, I'm not sure how crisply we can draw that distinction. It's a little obscure, like, do rocks have consciousness? Like Bill was saying in his paper that he had some argument for how the causal interactions in a rock are different.
I was trying to explore.
I forget how exactly.
Quantum coherence, but...
quantum coherence.
Exactly the same.
Right, so the question
trying to get to the same place.
But then the question is, does a rock have a presiding occasion, a presiding personality or not?
I sort of tend to think no, but maybe James would say yes, and I don't really have any strong opinion about it. So, like, you know, this is the question.
But is a house the summation of its efficient causes?
No. Nothing is a summation of its efficient causes, because efficient cause is not all explanatory, because everything's got at least four causes in a minimum.
So it's a summation of, but there's lots of efficient causes.
That's right.
Is there one formal? I guess there's lots of formal causes too.
Well, it depends on how you look at it.
Triangles, rectangles.
No. Yeah, that's in that sense. That's right. Lots of formal, but also the blueprint is sort of an overall formal cause. But again, here you're dealing with a manufactured thing.
And well, it's easier for me to think.
I know, but that's why the other one's more interesting. See, if we get hung up on the artifact one, our minds get really confused. We have to start with the other one, and then work our way to the manufactured one. If we try to go the other way, we end up with complete conceptual confusion. Like, the hard one is the interesting one. What is a natural entity?
But each occasion is self-organizing.
That's what I would say. I would say, or certainly each society is self-organizing.
Right.
And so I think occasions may or may not be self-organized. We can argue about that. It's a little hard to say. But certainly the system, all autopoietic systems, I would claim, have a higher grade occasion presiding over them.
Right.
But it is not clear to me that assemblies like rocks have a higher grade occasion presiding over them. It has to be thought through. I don't really know. I just haven't been able to get any really good purchase on that particular issue. And I haven't thought about it that much, but...
Well, these natural systems, like people, they would just be recursively their own causes in a certain sense.
But Whitehead talks about an actual occasion as being its own cause recursively also. So these are obscure questions because the theory of self-organization, as we receive it from science, is always about systems of interactions among self-existing particles.
Yeah.
Which is not really what we want it to be, process thought, and so...
See, we lose sophistication when we think that way?
Yeah.
Okay, that's why it's more easy to understand.
Exactly.
So that's a place where we need to translate networks of occasions into societies, into...
Okay, now, efficient causes in process, as we said, they're empathic and telepathic, and they include feeling and memory and other things. I don't want to get into all that right now. But you had asked, Michael, is the cause different from the effect? So I thought about that. It's really interesting in process theory because Whitehead rejects what he calls the fallacy of simple location. And the fallacy of simple location is the idea that any entity exists in any specific location in space-time. Right, so the idea that I am here is the fallacy of simple location, because in fact, I am over there where I'm having effects in you, right? And so Whitehead says an entity is wherever it's having causal effects, right? There's a whole different way of thinking about it. And, of course, this fits with quantum theory, where an electron, for example, is not, it's not a thing over here. An electron is actually sort of an extending sphere of influence. And that's what it actually is, according to the physical description. It's a expanding field of influence with an implicit center. But it's not there. It's wherever its influence is. Yeah, so in that sense, the cause and the effect are the same. On the other hand, in process theory, the way that a cause impacts a subsequent occasion is subject to interpretation. And so in that sense, the cause is not the same as the effect. And so the cause both is and is not the same as the effect in process theory. Okay?
Good.
Okay.
Would you say that again, please?
Yes, in process theory, insofar as we acknowledge the fallacy of simple location, and insofar as we recognize that an entity is wherever it's having effects, in that sense, the cause and the effect are the same thing, because the entity causing it and the effect, right, because it is wherever it's having an effect, so it's the same thing that's having the effect that was the cause. On the other hand, there's this gap in process theory.
between the cause and the effect, because the new occasion that's forming receives the cause as it was, but the effect it has is mediated by the interpretation. And so in that sense, the cause and the effect are not the same, because the effect is mediated by the entity upon which the effect is being exercised.
Would you say that's where abstraction comes in?
Yeah. It seems like they're not the same, only
abstraction,
or
yes, interpretation. That's right, abstraction comes in. Number one, abstraction, and number two, emphasis. Both, right?
Well, in the creative advance, that's where they're different, because one's at a different time in the creative advance.
Yeah, but Whitehead's saying no. See, Whitehead says that the cause is in the effect. That the effect is the thing itself. Right? So like the electron, for example, is a probability field. And so when another occasion intercepts that probability field and makes a decision about it, the probability field is changed by the decision. Right? And so the way in which the cause affects the new occasion is not unambiguously given by the cause. So for example, there's a quantum collapse, and that quantum collapse might subsequently be experienced as a positive spin or a negative spin. But that decision is made by the occasion that receives it. Something like that, right?
It's the effect is...
The effect is not the same as the cause. The effect is kind of a limitation on the cause or something, right? And so it is the entity affecting, but the effect is not predictable just on the basis of the cause. In other words, the cause does not predict its outcome entirely.
It's influential?
It's influential. It sets the parameters.
It's like partial causation?
The cause affects the field of possibilities, but it doesn't determine which possibility will be actualized.
It just limits.
It limits, but not all the way. And the occasion itself does the final limitation.
Mm. It's like a probabilistic attractor, yeah?
I don't know what a probabilistic attractor means.
Well, instead of being a deterministic cause, it's exerting a probabilistic field of causation.
Beautiful. Yeah. And so in that sense, that's beautiful. Yeah. Now, this is one of those issues in process theory that needs help from quantum theory, right? Is this particular issue we're discussing about these probabilities and how they get determined. But there's a lot of questions in there that I have not been able to answer. I'm hoping that Bill and I get together, we can sort some of this out. But in general, I will say this, that the cause is like a probability field. And so the probability field is just what the occasion has become. There's nothing else to the occasion but the probability field. And so that probability, wherever that probability field is, the occasion is. And in that sense, the cause and the effect are the same. But because it's a probability field, the actual effect of that cause has to be determined by the receiver of the cause. And so in that sense, there's a difference.
But we still have this problem of how is a new occasion actually distinguished? How is a new center or a moment of influence actually distinguished?
That's a huge question, right? And Whitehead assigns the responsibility to that, both to creativity and to God, in different ways, right? So creativity becomes the ongoing potential for concrescence, right? So that every universe will be reduced to a new experience. However, the particular aim, and also I believe the particular position in the universe, where that new perspective comes, we have to ask where does that come from? And Whitehead assigns that to the ultimate ordering factor, or to God, or the cosmic mind, if you call it. And I'm thinking a lot about that. It's really interesting, but I don't want to get too deeply into it right now. But
what's the basics of how he sort of justifies that, or why he makes that move?
Well, he does it mainly on the ontological principle. And the ontological principle says, no actual occasion, no reason. That the only reasons why things are one way rather than another are the decisions of actual occasions. It's a methodological principle. Whitehead sets it up as an ideal. And he wants to account for everything that can be accounted for in terms of the decisions of actual occasions. And so now, he puts together his system, and he realizes that there are several things he needs for a system to function.
but he can't figure out how they got there, right? So, for example, the actual occasions that come into being have to have essentially correlated aims. This is like what Linda was talking about, right? Although Whitehead never actually says this, you can imagine that the whole universe is one concrescence, that everything belongs to, so the aims are sort of all coordinated. Now, it's not a Whiteheadian idea, it's an Aurobindian idea, but it's an interesting one.
Aims are already coordinated by the primal.
By, yes, by the primordial age of God, because if the aims weren't... What's this going on here? Because if the aims weren't coordinated, everything would just go into total chaos. Right? Because every occasion is spontaneous. And so if the aims weren't generally coordinated, all the separate decisions would lead to a complete atomization and destruction of all order. Yes?
Okay, so I feel floored by this point that you're making, but at the same time, I'm a little alienated by not having it applied to a real life example. So in the instance of, I have a loved one right now in Africa, so if he thinks about me, and then whatever the effect of that thought could be positive or negative, can you apply some of the theory that you're talking about to that instance? So in other words...
Yeah, I'm just a little confused. Yeah, go ahead.
So the point that you're making, and the point that it sounds like Whitehead's making, is that the sphere of influence is subject to this fallacy of location. It's right. Not limited to location. So therefore, that's why I thought, okay, my brother's in Africa.
Right.
You know, I'm sure he's thinking about me periodically.
And I'm sure that every time he thinks about you, you feel it. Because it's a telepathic objectification, right? His high-grade occasions and your high-grade occasions are in proximity in the mental world. And so whatever's happening to him affects you more than it affects me, mm-hmm. right? You have a preferential connection to him via telepathic objectification among high-grade actual occasions. Mm-hmm. That part's easy to account for. What we're talking about here is something else. We're talking about the gap between successive actual occasions.
Right,
which is a different issue.
I would agree with Whitehead. It sounds like that it's enigmatic, therefore it's only explicable by God.
Right, but the particular ways in which it's enigmatic are very important. Gulam.
Excuse me. I forgot the name of the animals. Not lemmings, similar to lemmings. Mm-hmm. The telepathic thought was in Second World War. Mm-hmm. That love was so close between the child and the mother that no matter how far the mother and child was,
right.
The minute the child was, I'm sorry to say that, quote unquote, to be killed, and the mother would start crying in that instant.
That's right. That's an example of this.
And that was during the Second World War. They were using that.
Right.
It's a communication of instant communication, they call it.
Wow. Fascinating. So that's exactly, see, we can account for that easily in terms of transphysical process metaphysics.
It's similar to lemmings.
We're talking about something else, though. So you just change the subject. I want to come back to the subject we're on. The subject we're on is what happens between actual occasions. Right? So I'm saying that my personality is a sequence of actual occasions. Right, so one actual occasion ends, and then another occasion is going to begin. And the fact is that I don't have control over that. Because between now and the next occasion, there could be an earthquake and I could die. Right? And so then it wouldn't happen. Right? Or maybe I would just drop dead, or maybe I'd have a brain aneurysm. You know, so I don't control whether or not the next occasion of my personality will show up. Now, part of it's controlled by the rest of the universe. Right, because like if it was an earthquake, I wouldn't show up for that reason, right? But also, if you look at it, step back from it a little more abstractly. An occasion ends, and it leaves behind a whole universe of actual occasions. Right? Somewhere in that universe, there will be a concrescence. Where will it be? Will it be? Will the universe concrescence in such a way that it enables my personality to continue, or won't it? There's a gap between every instant. There's this gap, right? In a certain sense, like I'm gone, there's a universe there, and it's about to concrete, and I'm not there at that moment.
right? Somehow I've expired, my last occasion expired, and now there's a universe, and maybe it will produce an occasion that will continue me, and maybe it won't. So the thing I really want to point out to you is the radical gap that exists between occasions, particularly in the case of personally ordered occasions like we are. At the end of every breath, there's a gap. And we might or might not arise again out of that gap. So I'm trying to bring to your attention that quality, that every time we make a decision, we step off a cliff into a new universe. And we may or may not be in that universe into which we're stepping. And what are the factors that decide whether or not there will be a concrescence that will receive my personality in this new universe? Do you understand the question I'm asking? You'll see in Whitehead scholarship that this question gets buried and ignored. Because there's an assumption that when Whitehead says there will be another concrescence, there's an assumption that it will continue the personally ordered society. But there's nothing in process metaphysics that requires that.
But that's what would make it coherent. If it didn't, it wouldn't be coherent.
No, it would be coherent. I mean, I could die between now and the next moment. The universe wouldn't lose coherence.
But there would be no causal reason why you wouldn't show up in the next.
Well, what I'm saying is that we have to look at the factors, right? And I'm saying that between any two occasions, there's a kind of dissolution to the universal mind, basically, right? So that we are constantly dissolving into and emerging out of the cosmic mind. We make a decision. The results of that decision, as it were, go back into the cosmic mind, and then the cosmic mind produces a new occasion. But I don't produce a new occasion. It does. And the question is, what are its criteria for producing an occasion? It will want to decide to conquest the new universe in the way that will reveal the most value, that will achieve the most value. Now, generally, it will achieve that value by continuing me. But sometimes, there's a better way to achieve value in that universe than by continuing me. And also, it may be there are a number of places in the universe where an occasion could be profitably put. And somebody has to decide among them, and it can't be the occasion itself. There's got to be some other decider that helps to determine the aim and the position of each new concrescence. Now, this is speculative, and it's, you don't have to believe me, but I think it's a really interesting idea, and it certainly is a consequence of process metaphysics, which I consider really amazing, to think that the decision to create the next occasion that will allow me to finish this sentence is in God's hands. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Right? To feel the intimacy of God's permission for me to continue existing in each moment, right?
Or the causing it, not just allowing it, but actually creating it.
Well, no, what I meant by allowing was that he allows my personal order to continue.
Oh,
this is what Leibniz said. This is the way he used occasions. He actually used that same word.
Well, Whitehead's occasions are very quite different. They're majorly different in two ways. One is that Leibniz occasions are windowless. They are not involved in causal interactions with anything else. And also, they endure through time. Whitehead's occasions are completely causally open, radically open, and they don't endure through time.
It sounds like they're not completely open if it's still up to something else to decide.
No,
if whether your decision
that's part of the openness. That's part of the openness. The actual occasion is open to God, open to creativity, open to the entirety of the past, and completely shaped by all those. And in fact, those are part of its own stuff, its own being, are all these things of which it consists, which are not itself. So Leibniz monadology, Whitehead says, was destroyed by his adherence to substantialism. So that Leibnizian monads are substances, whereas Whiteheadian actual occasions are processes. And it's a completely different metaphysical. There's a certain similarity, but metaphysically it's radically different in the way it's carried out. Yes, James.
I'm wondering if I'm the only person here that really doesn't understand why Whitehead made the leap to God. Am I the only one that doesn't? I mean, I'm trying to get a complete understanding. And when I took Whitehead, I really didn't get it, but I let it
go. Well, because Whitehead when he carried through his program of analyzing actuality in terms of actual occasions, he discovered that he needed God to perform certain functions. He needed some, right? No, this is, no. Science, why is that funny?
Science does too, like you said.
Exactly, science does too, right?
Well, isn't that just the fact that you can't ever get outside your system? There always has to be something greater because we can't step outside the system we're in and get all the answers.
That's nice. But more specifically, you see, what's interesting about Whitehead is that he produces this philosophy which brilliantly accounts for science and why it works. And he accounts for science and why it works in a way which makes the mind-body problem disappear and everyday life also be intelligible. I forgot what we were talking about. What did you just say to me?
Why we needed...
Why God, right? So having done that, he discovered that there were certain things that hadn't been accounted for. Right? So, for example, the coordination of aims among occasions is necessary if a process universe will be coherent. And yet, an occasion can't provide its own aim. So, God provides the aims, right? And then I claim, and I'm not sure I'm right about this, that the position of the concrescence also needs to be decided, and that God is also involved in that. Right? So what's nice about it is that we have this system which accounts for science in everyday life really elegantly without bringing a lot of extra hypotheses, and then we discover that the system has a requirement for a certain cosmic principle to bring in order. And so in a certain way, God becomes metaphysically discovered, right? Because God only comes in as necessary. So it's not, you don't start with God, but Whitehead's God is sort of derived by a certain logical necessity from certain principles, which makes it kind of interesting.
How is it different?
But hold on, I'm going to put
one. I just wonder if in a sense that you could call God the ultimate aim, then.
God provides the aims. God is more than the aim. And Whitehead has a very complex analysis about that. Primordial nature of God, and the consequent nature of God, and the different functions they perform, and so forth. Right? Now, people try to do Whitehead without God, and you can find articles about that. Some people don't like the fact that he brought God in. I don't think he brought God in enough, myself. But,
I know, but it sounds like mumbo jumbo when you read it.
Doesn't sound like that to me. It sounds really elegant and powerful and convincing. So I don't know. One man's mumbo jumbo is another man's something else, right? I mean, I don't agree with Whitehead, but I find his arguments fascinating and very cogent. Mike?
I also find it moving, but I also don't see how it's different from the prime mover philosophical move.
The primordial nature of God in Whitehead is almost identical to Aristotle's prime mover. You probably got it from there. Now, Whitehead complicates his notion of God by adding in the consequent nature, but if he had stayed just at the primordial nature, it would be basically an Aristotelian move. It is a prime mover. The primordial nature of God is almost indistinguishable from Aristotle's prime mover. Yeah.
But the consequent nature brings in the fact that we have to experience God for God to be part of our prehension, and thus makes it a full, complete circle.
That's correct. And also that God prehends us. Mm-hmm. There's actually an important point there, right? So that our experience, God experiences our experience, and that way there's this kind of salvation that Whitehead brings in. Mm-hmm. Because God, as he experiences our experience, in some way perfects it.
God's changeable. He can be influenced.
God's consequent nature is changeable, but primordial nature is not.
Yeah. You said earlier that for the highest grade occasion, cannot separate between lower grade. There is no actual separation or difference between lower grade.
No, I said ontologically they're the same type. That's what I said.
So that
there is clearly separation between them, but they're ontologically of the same type. They're separated by grade, but they're ontologically of the same type.
What does that mean, though? That I think I understand because I heard you say that, and I was thinking there's still some ambiguity there in terms of this question.
Say it again. What's the question?
So, what does it mean that they're ontologically of the same type if they're also different? What's the distinction
well,
there?
Well, like all plants are plants, but bougainvilleas are not the same as pine trees, but they're all plants.
So they are a general category, let's say.
Yeah. So there's a general category of existence, actual things. In other words, there are some properties that all things share merely by virtue of being actual. And those are the properties of actual occasions. Of course, there's immense difference because every actual occasion is unique. And they can be divided up in all kinds of ways and sorted into different categories, but they're all actual occasions. Just like all plants are plants, even though you can divide them up in all kinds of different ways and categorize them and so forth. But
of the high-grade actual occasion has certain capabilities that do not inhere in lower-grade actual occasions, even though they're both basically the same type of thing. They're just infinitely complex in more complex ways, I would say.
Yeah, that's it. They're infinitely complex in more complex ways, but they're each, every actual occasion is a complete individualization of the universe. Every actual occasion has an aim. Every actual occasion goes through the process of concrescence in certain similar ways. Every actual occasion both feels and imagines and makes decisions and anticipates. These are true for every actual occasion, all the way from a subatomic particle up to maybe the cosmic occasion of the universe, if you want to hypothesize that, right? They're all actual occasions. For Whitehead, God is almost an actual occasion. But it's a unique actual occasion. It's the only unique actual occasion. But it also is built along the same lines, even though they're different. Right. So that's his explanatory ideal.
So the highest occasion doesn't contain these lower grade occasions necessarily.
No.
There isn't one higher grade occasion in which you fit all lower. That's not what he's trying to say.
That's not what he's trying to say. I mean, we can play around with that. I mean, I don't think that Whitehead would not want to say that. Whitehead would want to keep them all separate. Maybe there'd be some argument we could make in favor of Linda's proposition. I think Aurobindo would want to go in that direction, and I thought about it, but Whitehead wouldn't go there.
So all of reality isn't, because that's how I've been interpreting it, where he's actually saying all of reality is one occasion.
No, Whitehead never says that. Whitehead is a radical pluralist in that sense. Whitehead says every actual occasion transcends the universe out of which it emerged. And every actual occasion transcends God for Whitehead. It's completely, you know, autonomous in its moment of concrescence. Yes?
Oh, shit.
Okay. Let's see what we're doing in time. Okay, yes, Caleb?
So you were talking earlier about this seeming like a digital nature of occasions, and they pop and pop like this, right? And I was just imagining that the physical world had a certain frequency of this actual occasions to come about.
Yeah.
And the transphysical world might be much higher resolution of actual occasions that are happening, and we only see like slices of that.
I don't mean by higher resolution.
Well, like a resolution meaning like a frequency, like a much greater frequency.
Well, in terms of frequency, it seems to me that the higher the grade of the occasion, the lower the frequency.
Hmm.
Right. I'm arguing against New Age thought, right? It seems very clear to me that the lower the grade of an occasion, the faster it cycles. So during the eighth of a second, that's my cycle time, there must be trillions of subatomic
to make up a complex.
Right. Yeah. And so in general, I would think the higher the grade of the occasion, the lower the frequency of its rhythm.
But when it comes to duration of an occasion, that we don't really talk about how long that is, right?
Well, we can get back to that. In Whitehead, it's a very weird issue.
Because
when we talk about concrescence, we'll talk about that.
Because you see how in the physical world, when we're talking about time and space, you might be able to measure things.
Well, it's very clear that higher grade occasions take longer.
Mm.
That's clear. And Whitehead says that, and it's obviously clear, because basically Whitehead says that every entity requires a certain finite period of time in which to express its complexity.
He didn't say how long those are. But
no, he never says how long they are, and that's a whole issue that Whitehead doesn't clarify well, and we'll talk about why, but I agree with you that actual occasions differ in their duration, and that the higher the grade of an occasion, the longer it is. Whitehead also says that, but he doesn't fully work out the implications of it in a way that I find satisfactory.
When we record something like a video tape digitally, we're taking only samples. Like film is 24 frames per second, so it takes a picture every 24 times a second.
Right.
And that's what I'm thinking, that maybe physical reality is like that compared to transphysical reality. Like it's the frame rate is
higher.
It seems it would be lower though.
Wait, the lower grade occasions?
Well, the frame rate of the duration of the occasions would be...
The lower the grade, the quicker the duration.
Yeah.
So you're trying to bring it to resolution, and that makes it seem like transphysical would be less resolved.
Yeah, then...
Right. I know resolution.
Resolution is how many pictures you take in a second. 24 is...
Right, so look, the higher the grade of the occasion, the longer the exposure and the greater the density of the pixels.
that's a total reverse of,
I know.
Of digital, like digitization. When we do digital,
yeah, I don't know what you're talking about, Caitlin. You come from another angle again. Let's hold this because it's a whole other way of thinking. I haven't got it. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, right before Caleb's question, what you said about each actual occasion being transcendent,
yeah,
really seemed to me to be the opposite of what you were saying when I, as a high grade actual occasion, have no control over whether I show up, you know, as a new actual occasion.
Well, I'm trying to reconcile. The actual occasion is transcendent in that once it has come into being,
oh, okay,
it will make a free decision that it will impose on the subsequent universe and on God.
Okay, but then before you were saying that it doesn't, like, there could be an earthquake, so I won't show up. So I'm not understanding what the distinction is.
I just said.
Yeah, I still don't understand.
Well, the point is, it's every actual occasion is both imminent and transcendent in different senses, right? No actual occasion can come into being except out of a universe of past actual occasions and creativity and God and the eternal objects. They're all necessary for every actual occasion. On the other hand, in the process of concrescence, there is a moment of freedom.
Okay.
And that moment of freedom transcends the universe out of which the occasion has arisen.
So if I decide to stop breathing, and there's no earthquakes and none of that other dire stuff coming from outside, my aim trumps that of the universe in that particular...
That's right. Or if you decide to say the sentence you just said, your aim trumps the universe,
yeah,
because I'm forced to hear the words that you said, like it or not, right?
Okay.
And so you transcend me in that particular sense.
So there's both, quote-unquote, determinism
and
freedom. Free will.
Absolutely. And the question is not, is there one or the other? The question always is, how do they work together?
Yeah.
Right? Because you can't have a universe without both. And so the question of metaphysics is not how do you count the universe in terms of one or the other. It's rather, how do you work with both? Bill?
Yeah, I think I got it. So, very related to what Richard's saying, I think. So, an actual occasion, its concrescence happens outside of space-time, but after the decision, it's come into
that's
space.
What Whitehead
if it's
says.
A low-grade occasion.
Also. That's what Whitehead says. I don't agree with it, but that's what Whitehead says.
And your disagreement is?
What?
Your disagreement is?
But I don't think it happens outside of space-time.
For low-grade occasion.
For any occasion. They're all the same.
Wow. I thought transphysical. What do you mean by physical when you say transphysical? Must mean low-grade occasions versus...
Well, transphysical means higher-grade occasions operating in ontological independence from low-grade occasions, by
and
large.
They're outside of space-time.
What?
They are happening outside of
space. Well, no. You say outside of space. You can't say that. You have to say outside of which space-time. No actual occasion ever occurs outside of space-time. However, there are different space-times.
Yeah, but okay.
There are different space-times. And so the space-time of the waking world is one space-time. And the space-time of the transphysical world is a different space-time. And there are complex relations between them. We'll talk about that in chapter 9.
Geometries.
What? Yeah. Okay. Let's take a break. What I want to do after break, I really want to have time for another discussion like last time, because that was great. And so what I'd like to do after class, we have 2 weeks of chapter 6. How about, you guys go to reading? Let's see that. So why don't we do this? After break, let's have our discussion time. And I'm going to ask you guys to discuss issues arising from chapter 6. And then after, we'll have a discussion about that. And out of that discussion, I'll come up with a lecture for next week. How's that sound? So concrescence is the process through which an actual occasion comes into being. Whitehead identifies two different ways of analyzing actual occasions, the genetic and the coordinate. I think I should go into that. So we'll talk about the genetic, however. So Whitehead says that if we analyze an actual occasion, which is a drop of experience, into smaller components, the smaller components are also drops of experience. Right? That makes sense? Right? Okay. So the smaller drops of experience that compose a larger drop of experience are called prehensions. And Whitehead makes it clear that apprehension is just like an actual occasion, except that it gets its subjective aim from the occasion that it belongs to. Make sense? Okay. So Whitehead sort of imagined it like this. The actual occasion starts, and these lines represent the causal prehensions. These are the effects of past actualities on the new occasion. This line doesn't really make any sense. I'm just using it to represent the occasion, but if you think too much about the line, you'll get confused. The diagram's not that great. But these represent the causal prehensions, actual occasions from the past impacting on the new occasion. And then, at that point, for Whitehead and for me, each causal prehension generates a conceptual prehension. Right? So I see a red thing, and the conceptual prehension is red and thin. Right? So I pull the idea out of what I've seen. I abstract the forms out of the actuality that I've prehended. And then I have a conceptual prehension. Now, this is a very interesting move that Whitehead makes, because Whitehead says that if actual occasions are going to be spontaneous, they have to have room for choice, right? And where does the room for choice come in? And so Whitehead says that if each actual occasion prehends past actual occasions and just has to sort of accept them as they are, there's no room for choice in the whole thing. And so Whitehead says, no, what actually happens is we receive something from the past and we generate a conceptual prehension which pulls out into our attention the forms that are ingredient in that past actuality. Okay? Everybody okay with that? Then there will be a subsequent occasion, let's say this one here, in which both the original causal prehension and the idea are both prehended simultaneously. So this is a propositional prehension prehending this conceptual prehension and this physical prehension together. Right? And if the occasion does that, if the occasion says yes to this, then this becomes part of the final satisfaction. Okay? It's prehended by the final satisfaction. But let's say in this case, there's a causal prehension, it generates a conceptual prehension, and then there's a subsequent conceptual prehension which varies it. So for example, I see something and it's red, and I think it could be green. Right? So that's sort of a conceptual reversion, but it's also another conceptual prehension. And then I can form a propositional prehension which brings together this original prehension with this reverted conceptual prehension, and then so that thing that came to me from the past as being red is now green for all subsequent occasions that prehend me. Right? So I made it introduce novelty by means of this sequence of conceptual and propositional prehensions. I've introduced novelty, which then becomes part of the final satisfaction. Or I might later on form another propositional prehension, which will take this proposition, which says, it says this entity is green, and it will compare it to the causal prehension and decide whether the reversion is correct or not. Right? And so you can see how we have these different physical prehensions, conceptual prehensions, and propositional prehensions. And the propositional prehensions get assembled into more and more complex propositions, until finally at the end of the concrescence, there's one complex proposition, having interpreted the past and made the decisions for the future. And so in this way, a concrescence is a concrescence of prehensions. That makes sense? Yeah.
The prehension on the lines you show coming in,
yeah.
Now are they, sometimes it seems like you talk about them as independent entity of some sort, or I'm thinking of the prehension as part of the compressing occasion.
Yeah, now here's
and
the
you're
thing.
Showing some of it is.
Well, this is what I want to talk about. See, so this is the fundamental place where my analysis differs from Whitehead. And if you're going to be reading Whitehead, so I want to make this clear. For Whitehead, this whole thing is the compressing, right? And so
this process of the causal prehension is in time, right? It's like, you know, propagates at the speed of light, there it is, it comes in, right? But for Whitehead, this whole process is not in time. It's outside of time, right? And so Whitehead talks about this as being, what does he say? He says that there's succession, there's an order of succession of prehensions in an occasion, but this whole thing is not in time, right? So this whole process will happen, and then this occasion will enter into time and be prehended by future occasions. But right here, this is not in time. So even though he analyzes it as an unfolding process, he wants to deny that it's happening in time, right? I find that really bewildering. And I think it's one of the most weird and weak parts of Whitehead's theory. But he got there for an honest reason. And the honest reason he got there was an analysis of Zeno's paradoxes, right? Which appear to prove that if time is continuous, in order for something to start, it first has to start to start, and then it has to start to start to start, and so you can never get anywhere. And so he says time has to have discontinuities in it, or there's no movement at all. I haven't worked that out in detail. That's what he says, right? And so what I've said is that what Whitehead did not have available to him at that time was the idea of fractal ordering. Right? So the question is a question of continuity versus discontinuity. If we assume that time is continuous, we run into Zeno's paradoxes. But if we assume it's discontinuous, we end up with this weirdness of this whole process that's happening that's not in time. So my proposal is that we recognize time as fractal. So that means that each actual occasion, in effect, is an arrest in time. It's something in it is sort of like out of time. But if you look inside of it, there are other actual occasions which are also discrete. And within each one of those, there are other discrete occasions. Right? And so you get the idea that you get a big concrescence, like my concrescence, an eighth of a second, and you get my cellular concrescences, a hundredth of a second, and then my molecular concrescences, a millionth of a second, and so forth, right? And so my duration is sort of a whole thing, right? It's got its own internal integrity. In a certain sense, it's not unfolding in time, but all of its components are, right? So this way you get digital components all the way down. But by ordering it fractally, you're midway between continuity and discontinuity. And I think this really improves the flow of Whitehead. And so what I would say is that this whole thing is a high-grade actual occasion in the created advance. And as this actual occasion is concrescing, it contributes to the formation of all of these other actual occasions, each one of which is an occasion in its own right. Right? Now, Whitehead denies these, the status of occasions in their own right, because Whitehead says they all get their subjective aim from the overall concrescence. So therefore, they're not ontologically independent. But it's clear to me that Whitehead's own theory is that every actual occasion gets its subjective aim from God, so it isn't independent either. And so what I'm suggesting is the relationship between God and actual occasions is duplicated in the relationship between actual occasions and their prehensions. So these are actual occasions in their own right. However, because they're forming while this is forming, the overall aim of this influences the aim of all the occasions that come into being in unison with it. Right? And so insofar as these occasions share in the aim of the larger concrescence, they are its prehensions. But for me, that's a relative thing, right? So that any one actual occasion can serve as a prehension in any number of higher grade occasions, all of which are partially living through it. Right? That makes sense? Right? So in general, my aims dominate the aims of the occasion in my body pretty thoroughly, right? But each one of the occasions of my body has its own aim that's separate from mine.
Right? So, for example, if you try not to blink, you'll discover that your the actual location of your eyeball has names that are independent of yours, right? And it will enforce them on you if it's pushed far enough. But it generally accepts my aim for most purposes, but it's got its own stubborn independence, and it makes independent decisions that I have to live with. Right? So let's say, for example, I'm walking down this path, and I see a thing in the grass, and I say, oh, it's a snake, and I jump 6 feet in the air, which just happened to me, right? So the actual occasions in my nervous system at some point made a judgment. Oh, that's a snake. For me, it's a snake. That decision was already made, right? Its decision binds me. Now, I might form a subsequent propositional prehension of the form, is that really a snake? In which case, I would prehend the original thing and the idea of its being a snake and make a decision. Oh, no, it's just a stick. Oh, no, it's still moving. It is a snake, right? But the point is that these decisions get made along the way for us by these other occasions that belong to our body. And what I'm claiming is that the occasions that belong to our body have communication with occasions belonging to other bodies, have communication with other occasions in my body, and in fact that some other high-grade occasion might also use the occasions in my body as its concrescences, as its prehensions in some way. So that each one of us could belong to various higher grade occasions that are all partially working their way through us. So if, for example, we thought that the United States had a presiding occasion over it, I would be a prehension for that. And I'm also a prehension for the evolving universe, and I'm also a prehension for Gaia. Right? So I get to be prehensions for a number of higher grade occasions. And by the same token, various occasions become my prehensions to the extent that they're influenced by my aim. And also, I would suggest that to the extent they're influenced by my aim, they're more receptive to my propositions regarding them. Right? So because my arm identifies with me, when I form a proposition, my arm is going to raise straight up. It does. All I did was form a proposition. And it executed. I haven't got a clue how to break the molecules that give the energy to power the cells to contract the muscles to move my arm. I have no clue. It knows how to do that. I just form the proposition, raise up the arm, and it does it. Right? But I can say to the chalk, fly up in the air, and it doesn't. And a really interesting question, why not?
Well, it could.
It could in the case of psychokinesis, right? And so... So this is the whole thing we'll talk about as we go on, right? But I do want to clarify this business about concrescence and prehension. For me, they're relative. For Whitehead, it's an absolute distinction. And if you talk to any Whiteheadian but me, you have to know that. Because here's the odd thing, just to be really clear about it. A lot of casual Whiteheadians will not notice that I'm changing Whitehead. Because a lot of casual Whiteheadians assume that that's what Whitehead meant in the first place. But he actually didn't. So I'm just telling you this so you can talk to other Whiteheadians. Yeah?
Can you give an example of an actual occasion that's not a prehension?
I don't know. I suppose, in theory, any occasion might not be a prehension. I guess, no, for Whitehead, every occasion is a prehension because for Whitehead, every actual occasion is a prehension for the subjective, consequent nature of God.
So if every actual occasion is a prehension, and every prehension is an actual occasion, what makes them different?
It's a relationship.
It's the relationship.
It's a relationship. Oh, it's a certain high-grade occasion can induce lower-grade occasions to function as its prehensions. Right?
Mm-hmm. But then, do I have, am I a prehension for my organs as well as my organs as a prehension for me?
No, it's not symmetrical. Right, this is interesting, I haven't fully worked it out, but it seems clear to me that lower grade occasions objectify for me as other entities, but higher grade occasions objectify for me as purposes and aims.
They don't really know that you exist?
They know that I exist, but I don't really know that they exist in the same way. I experience them as a pattern of influence, not as an object. I experience lower grade occasions as objects, but not higher grade occasions, which I experience as sort of conditions, environing conditions. Hmm. Right? So I haven't fully thought this out, whether or not, like for example, let's take a rock, and that's where James left, whether we assume that it has a consciousness or not. If the rock prehends me, it prehends me as a minor disturbance in the gravitational gradient, period. Right? So it only objectifies me in a way appropriate to its grade. Mm. But I might also be influencing that. Let's say I'm successfully levitating that rock. It would be experiencing me, but not as an object. As an object, I could only be part of the gravitational gradient. But it experienced me as somehow intrinsic to its subjectivity. Right? So it doesn't, but see how I'm getting at? There's something asymmetrical here.
You're saying like America feels you, but you don't really feel America?
No. I'm saying that America objectifies me, but I can't objectify America in the same way. Mm. Right?
So we have a distinction between prehensions and objects there. Which I don't know why you would just use the language of the prehension is in the concressing occasion, and the things being prehended are the expired occasions that are now objects.
That's what Whitehead does, but I disagree with him for a whole bunch of reasons. And I think that, in fact...
Because you can't do this biological hierarchy without that.
You can't do the embodiment. I couldn't generate a satisfactory theory of embodiment using Whitehead's technicalities as they were stated. Whitehead's idea of the concrescence is as being private to the occasion, and the occasion as being sort of outside of time, got in the way of what I was trying to do. So I honored Whitehead's dance with Zeno, but I came up with a different way by bringing in a more modern idea of the fractal organization.
How do you mean fractal?
It's self-similar. I mean fractal is self-similar.
Right.
So at every level, there are lower grade occasions, but they're always discrete. So it's not continuous, it's discrete at every level, but at every level there's a lower level and a higher level.
Let's see, they're all concrescing at this issue. So a big occasion is concrescing slowly over top of super fast occurring electrical activities within a cell, and also the say the neural activities of the cell are all right. So you're separating, you're saying prehension is what the higher grades do to the lower, and higher grade is not a prehension as itself to a lower grade occasion. It's a gravitational field. It's something in the environment.
Yeah, it's all still apprehension, but it's, in other words, again, I guess I'm not trying to say this. I would say that a high grade occasion can prehend a lower grade occasion in a causal prehension, right? So that's already finished. You finished, I prehend you, okay? Or the desk finished and I prehend the desk, right? An actual occasion that I prehend it, right? Or it can make it into a prehension. Right? In other words, in a more intimate way. I suppose the causal prehensions are sort of on the border, right? But the point is that all these other occasions, the conceptual prehension and the propositional prehensions, each of which is an occasion, are occasions in their own right.
Right. That's where you want the similar and
subsimilar. Right. And so every occasion can be a prehension for higher grade concrescences. And it can be a prehension for multiple concrescences. And so this really opens up the actual occasion in a much more radical way than Whitehead did.
How can it be more radical than the entire...
Because for Whitehead, all this is internal to the occasion. For me, it's all open.
Okay, yeah, I was confused about that too.
Right.
So that diagram in some ways looks like your fractal thing, but interpreted differently.
Yeah.
That's all one grade of occasion.
What?
That's all one grade of occasion for Whitehead.
This is all one high-grade occasion, and these are all lower-grade occasions that are caught up in its ordering field of its aim, and that are functioning as prehensions for it.
Damn, man, this is like practically learning.
learn science all over again.
Yes, that's it. Exactly, it's a new scientific language, right?
It's not simple, a lot of detail.
Can you just say again how using the fractal image gets you to be able to say that the occasion is both in time and not in time?
Yes, because it's difficult, but time for Whitehead is the relationship between actual occasions. Where it's not something that happens inside of actual occasions. But there's a succession in actual occasions. It's really confusing. I just don't think Whitehead's idea works. It's just too full of paradoxes. But so Whitehead's idea would be that here's one occasion, right? And all of this is internal to it. And then this occasion is objectified by means of this final satisfaction. This is what's known in the future. Right? There's another occasion over here. I mean, the time is going this way, so we have to come around, okay? So if this occasion is now coming into this occasion, it would get just the final satisfaction, just this, right? But I'm saying that this occasion, so here's this is the same as that, right? So I'm taking this whole thing and putting it here. Here's a subsequent occasion. For Whitehead, all the communication is right here. But I'm saying that all these other concrescences are all objectified over here, right? And so it's a much more complex system. Right, so all the possibilities that were considered earlier in this concrescence are also causally effective on this concrescence, not just the ones it finally decided upon. And so everything becomes causally open. Everything that happens inside of my experience is also public, as well as what happens when I objectify. Right? And so going back to Linda's question, so if I look at a sequence of actual occasions, time is the succession. But for Whitehead, the actual occasion itself doesn't take time. Right? And so it's out of time. And I say, okay, there's something about that I kind of get. It makes a decision, right? But then I'm saying that it makes a decision based on the lower grade concrescence that I've already made decisions for it that are functioning as its prehensions. And what was the question again?
It's both in time and out of time.
Right. And so each one of those lower grade occasions is also out of time. Right? But it's a smaller arrest in the context of a big one.
Oh, because there's still a sequence for all the lower ones to affect the higher ones.
That's right. So the lower ones have a sequence. And for Whitehead, that sequence is not in time. And for me, that sequence is in time. Because the occasion is radically open. If you look into the literature, there's a whole thing in the Whitehead literature about whether occasions can be open or closed. And they're still involved in all this old mental thinking. And so when they say the occasion is open, they're sort of thinking about geometrical models of opening it and stuff, right? But I'm opening up the temporal dimension instead of the spatial dimension. Right? By saying that time permeates the actual occasion all the way down. Each individual prehension may be a small arrest in time, but within that, you can then find other smaller arrests, right? And so time is kind of fractal that way.
So if you go up to a higher part, into the one ultimate concrescence, in a sense, it's out of time.
In a sense, it is, right? Just all time is internal to it.
Kind of get
you. In a sense, all time would be internal to that. Whitehead talks about that in one of his earlier books. He speculates about that, about some occasion in which all time would be eternal. He doesn't come back to it again, but at one point he sort of plays around with that. And as I said, I think it's a really interesting idea. Okay, so I just wanted to clarify that. I think it'd be a dozen questions would come about that. So now let's see what the questions you guys came up with from your discussions, from your...
Michael had a question about time, and I was just wondering,
excuse me.
How does this relate
maybe you could articulate what your question was for people. We had a little bit of discussion of it, and then we had to come back. But, you know, in light of this, how does that all fit together?
It's so hard to articulate. I can't do it right now. I need to sort of bounce off.
Yeah, there's a lot in this to think about.
Well, we were kind of trying to bring it to the integral and saying that how can we stop thinking of all of this as occurring with the backdrop of linear time? But that's, I mean, it's what the assumption is of what we're doing, but just kind of trying to look and see what that would feel like and look like.
I can say it this way. You mentioned the gap between actual occasions before, and for me that gap suggests that there is something more fundamental than actual occasions, which is this space in which they move, which is sort of, like you said, the sequence itself taken as a whole.
No. Space they move is not the sequence taken as a whole. I lost you right there.
What is the actuality of the gap? What is the gap you're referring to? If an actual occasion is a fundamental component of reality, and that's what reality actually is on this system, what is the gap?
The gap is that one actual occasion ends, and another one begins. The gap is right there.
It's circular.
What?
It's circular, though.
You want to just define the gap, right?
Yes. What is it? If it's not an occasion, then what is it?
In other words, is it some sort of backdrop?
Well, in a sense, it is. And it's, I mean, it depends. For Whitehead, I don't know how to answer it. For Sri Aurobindo, it is God. It's the divine, right? Divine ground, the universal mind, whatever you want to call it. You get all very complicated about it, depending on how complex you want to get. But the point is that an occasion is an individualization of the universe. And it ends with a decision. Now what happens next? The universe has to re-individualize. That's the gap, right?
But
each actual occasion, the universe individualizes, right? So the universe does it. And so we have our own individual initiative, and then we surrender it, and the universe gives us back.
Okay, well, why doesn't that only happen once?
What do you mean? Because we don't...
There's a universe, and then it individualizes. Why does it re-individualize?
Because the individualization is just a moment, is a drop of experience. It doesn't individualize as a substance, it individualizes a drop of experience or an actual occasion.
But are you asking in that question, why is the universe persisting? Why does the universe exist, sort of? Or
All right. So Whitehead would say this, the actual occasion expires, and then there's a universe of past actual occasions, and creativity and God, and those three factors conspire to initiate a new actual occasion.
What were the three factors again?
Creativity, eternal objects, and God. I mean, really, creativity and God would do it in this case. Right? And so the point I'm making in this is that our existence, moment to moment, is a gift. That we do not know how to exist. We do not know how to arise out of the ground. That happens to us moment by moment as a gift. And the gift is not guaranteed. Because we might not arise in the same form in the next moment. Or maybe we won't arise at all, depending on who we are, right? Or what we are. We don't know yet, right? But the point is that in every moment we make a decision, and we cast it out to the world, and then we wait to see if we're going to exist again. And as we do, that existence is a gift from creativity and God.
Okay, but why the need for the different identities? Wouldn't identity just be arising out of... Concrescence is the only identity, it seems like.
Right.
In any sense, when we say we, we're just referring to the current concrescence.
Right.
Not the current concrescence here or there, but just the concrescence.
No. The specific concrescence here and there. When I say me, I mean this concrescence here, now, never to be repeated.
Didn't you just mention the fallacy of simple location, though? And
that's right. I mean, right now when it's happening, it's right here, but the effects are elsewhere.
And if that's it, if I heard you correctly earlier, then you were saying that the effects, you know, in a sense, are equivalent to the identity. So then to say you're here, you are here now, where, I mean, if you're having non-local effects diffuse across space-time, then...
I'm everywhere.
So then, and then what was the purpose of saying, what is the meaning of you're here now?
Because every entity, even in quantum physics, has a center. And now, once the center is finished functioning, it's gone. And it's just a wave of probabilities, right? But there is a place of origin. That's me, right now, I'm an origin. I'm having a moment of subjective immediacy. That's here. And then you experience it there. So I'm over there when you experience me, I'm over here when I'm experiencing it.
But it's a kind of spatial metaphor again, right? And it's assuming that there's some kind of linear flow, like, through space-time, right?
That's correct.
But, I mean, if we just take quantum entanglement, for example...
Quantum entanglement does not contradict the linearity of time. It complements it.
But there can be effects that are not attributable to linear flows through space time.
Yeah. I can have instantaneous effects elsewhere. That's not a problem. So and then I have, there are some effects that propagate at the speed of light and some that are instantaneous. They're different. I have no problem with that. I'm not sure what the question
is. So do you have to, how do you define where the center is? On what basis?
It's an empirical question. I'm always asking you.
To localize a center is it means you're outside of that center.
I mean, I'm not understanding the question. I feel like you guys are asking me questions from a perspective that I don't quite get. So I don't understand what the question is that is being asked of me. I'd like to try, but I don't get it.
I think this is a smaller question of that big question. In what sense are the possible, when we refer to possibilities, sort of like the prehension, it could be green. What is that? In what sense is that, or is the future or past possibilities actual now?
Well, this is again very much like quantum theory. I'm saying process philosophy has a doctrine of objective probabilities, just like quantum theory does, right? So that after an actual occasion, after a quantum event expires, it leaves a trace of itself in the field of probability, which can be described by means of the Schrodinger wave equation. And same thing with an actual occasion, only it's not so abstract. It functions, and it leaves behind it a field of potentiality for other concrescences to work with. So that's, in effect, what an actual occasion does. In the end, it probably does nothing else but objectify itself as probabilities, objective probabilities for future apprehension. Does that make sense?
I mean, there were other possibilities as well that came directly from the eternal objects.
What? Mm-hmm. Say it again.
When an occasion is deciding between possibilities, possibilities are the eternal objects.
Well, there are several different levels here, right?
Which are then, you know, further compromised by the different...
Exactly. So in other words, there is the primordial mind of God, or the complete envisagement of the order among the eternal objects, which is the same with all time. And it's timeless, a timeless ordering of possibility. But then, in the case of any given actual occasion, that total field of possibility is limited to that subset of those possibilities which are logically consistent with the past having been the way it was.
Right. So I understood that you were asking, where do those possibilities exist?
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, if possible for Whitehead, the possibilities in the abstract exist in the primordial mind of God. God is the actuality that makes the eternal objects relevant to individual occasions. Is that what you're asking?
It's sort of like I heard a theory that says, because we can't figure out why certain possibilities are actualized, and there are some people who say every possibility is actualized, and these are separate universes.
I consider that very uninteresting.
Yeah, to me too. So I feel like...
But basically what that does is it's basically a bid to deny choice to God.
Or to say that you have a model for God.
Well, it's not even a model. I find those theories aesthetically offensive. Because... because they're basically a cheap way to deny the functioning of final causes in the universe.
But what they do, I think their merit is that they say that possibilities in some sense has to be actual. So how are they actual? How is a possibility real? Because if it's not real, then it's just an abstraction.
Well, I agree with you. I've been talking to you about objective probabilities. Right? Just like quantum theory. I mean, I'm not saying anything. Why did it say nothing different from quantum theory here? I mean, what is the nature of objective probabilities? Well, they're tendencies for things to happen. Right? They are ways of restructuring the possibilities that are available to new concrescences. Right? There's no going behind this. In other words, we're saying that the final realities are actual occasions and eternal objects, right? Possibilities and actualities are the two main divisions within the real. So we're saying there are real probabilities and actual occasions. That's our fundamental metaphysical hypothesis. So we can't say what's an eternal object except to say that it's a specific possibility of determinateness, because this is our metaphysical ground. We can't, in this system, we don't go past that because we have no resources. We're taking this as the beginning of our definition. There might be some other system in which we can give a different answer to this, but not in process theory.
I think that's where a lot of the confusion is. People are testing the boundaries of this system and trying to correlate it to other systems. And you can only do that to a certain extent.
Well, you see, there's a methodological point that's coming up again and again. And what I want to say to you is that to do philosophy, you start with your philosophical system and you interpret everything into the system to see how far you can go, and then to fix the system or to abandon it, right? And so that's what you do, right? So if you want to compare, if you want to test process philosophy, you do it by translating the insights from other disciplines into process language and seeing if you can do that and seeing what you get from doing that. Does it open up new possibilities? Does it make you feel like you understand it better? Right? Or does it feel empty and trivial? These are all questions you have to ask. But the point is, the way you test the metaphysical theory is by translating insights from other systems into your metaphysical language. That's how you do it. Now, for example, it may turn out that your other system describes things that process metaphysics can't cope with. Then you have a really fun result. Then you've either got to abandon process philosophy or change it. That's how you do philosophy. Yeah?
The thing about quantum mechanics that might be relevant here, it's a kind of an expansion and contraction in the process. Because you consider a photon headed at a photographic plate, it's emitted by an atom someplace where it was localized, and then it spreads as a three-dimensional
cloud,
a wave packet, but it's a three-dimensional expanding sphere, and so the Schrodinger equation went from a peaked thing showing where it was, but not exactly, to this really distributed thing. So, however, when it gets captured by an atom on the photographic plate, kabam, it's back to, you know, the equation peaks again.
Right.
The wave equation shows more closely where it is.
That's right. So the question is, how do we translate this into process language?
Yeah, and I the expansion phase would be, then it's a cloud of possibilities.
I believe that is the objectification of an actual occasion. That's how it objectifies itself.
Yeah. Well, I would say that the objectification would be the collapse when it.
Well, you could say that too.
Or the.
Okay, you could get.
But
it still
is a collapse when you say a cloud of possibilities. That's a collapse.
What?
That's. To say a cloud of possibilities is to state it is a collapse.
No, because the fact is that there can be actual occasions that have collapsed, but have never had any causal impact in the universe at all. But 20 years from now, they might. And so those possibilities are existing somewhere, in some way, even if they're not collapsed yet. Because somehow, whatever it is that the Schrodinger wave equation describes is a real part of the actual world. That probability field of which the Schrodinger wave occasion is a partial and abstract description, is real. It's there in some important sense. Right? It's not actual, but it's real. In other words, it has causal effect. It's real. And it probably is, that Schrodinger wave occasion probably is the objective immortality of the past actual occasions. That is how a quantum theorist would interpret objective immortality, is as a modification in that which is described by the Schrodinger wave equation. I haven't worked all this out. It's one thing I want to talk to Bill about, right?
I keep hearing him say Schrodinger wave occasion.
Yeah. Yeah. Equation. Right. Schrodinger wave equation.
One question about, is there a simultaneity? Is there a sense of simultaneity in this? Once you get relativity, there's not, but...
There is.
Say, considering a biological organism, all this...
I mean, for example, Whitehead talks about at one point in Processing Reality, he says it seems to him more natural to assume that there is direct objectification of all mental poles, which is not fallacy statement. So he's talking about telepathy. Whitehead himself says it's natural to process philosophy to assume telepathy. And telepathy is involving thoughts. Also, if you're involving thoughts, you're also involving probabilities, because I've defined thoughts as basically possibilities and probabilities, right? And so Whitehead's notion of telepathy would provide a process resource for the interpretation of non-local causation.
Right, okay. I would do it the other way, right? Let's see what I'm...
Yeah.
Well, I'm translating the other way.
Right, exactly. The translation has to go this way if you're doing philosophy.
Yeah, okay. Because other stuff is not... Philosophy's got no interiority. It's a,
exactly. So you can't... You have to go from the... Here's the point. Metaphysics always goes from the concrete to the abstract in its explanations. Metaphysics is explanatory of abstractions. Right?
Yeah, that's good.
Right? Whereas quantum theory starts with a set of abstractions and tries to deduce the concrete from that. Whitehead starts with the concrete and tries to derive the abstractions of quantum theory.
Okay, that's an arrow in it. More structured than just thinking, well, they're all ideas and they're not good at what they want.
That's right. Am I making sense? Is everything really confused, or is this going over? Like, I feel like I'm getting a lot of questions that I'm not able to fully. I don't quite know where they're coming from. So I want you to keep trying. But I'm not getting it.
You usually explain probabilities versus actualities by saying it's all reality, real and potential. Right?
That's right.
And then
it's all real.
But distinguishing
the actual from the possible.
The actual from the possible. But it's all real. That's what you're saying.
So, yeah.
Well, I was just... Whitehead says, I keep trying to find this quote, but very early on in one of his books, he talks about something like staying in the creative muddle. And basically, you know, we're really trying to get deep with this stuff.
Yes.
And the fact that we're having so much trouble with it, to me, is an indication that we're really trying to get it.
I agree.
And not just like, well, I'll write a paper and then I'll take another class next semester.
Right.
You know,
I,
it's
I
like
agree.
We're really like pushing the limits here.
Right.
And sometimes it looks like, whoa, we're not getting it. Getting
well, it's okay. I love the process. I'm just sharing my frustration because I like to know where the questions are coming from. Then they're really easy to answer. But I'm having trouble with some of these questions getting where they're coming from. Like, I can't quite tell what assumptions you're making that are different from my assumptions, and so I don't quite know how to answer it. So I find myself reiterating my assumptions again, which isn't the most useful thing. Right? So I get what I'm saying is I need more help from you in asking your questions.
Well, to get back to the first question about time, it seems to me that time is not a fundamental constituent a Whitehead system. So, you know, actual
why do you say that?
Huh?
Why do you say that?
Well, in other words, on a certain level, that the metaphysical building blocks, let's say, are actual occasions and eternal objects.
Yes. But actual occasions are atoms of time space.
Okay.
And so it's built right in there. An actual occasion is an atom of time.
But the concreteness that we start with is actual occasions.
Right.
And so it seems to me that we have to work out from that and eternal objects in some way in order to define the space-time that they're, or the time-space or whatever, that they're operating within.
Yeah, so there are two, one of the ways I talk about this in later chapters is that there are two different ways we talk about time-space, two different functions of it. And one function of time-space is that of containing. Another function is that of ordering. And we need to separate out those two functions so that every actual occasion contains, in a very literal sense, the entire past universe. Right? And it contains it across a duration, because every actual occasion to express itself takes some finite amount of time. Right? And so in effect, my actual occasion is all of space over a duration of time, right? So I contain it in that way. But then there are relations between actual occasions in terms of which one is next to which other one, which one is distant from other ones and things like that, right? And so that whole structure of relationship is what Whitehead calls it, or I call it, time-space relation. It's a function. It's a function of interrelationship, right? In other words, you have actual occasions. Every actual occasion contains all the past. But for example, in the waking world, there's a certain group of contemporary of actual occasions that were just 1 minute ago in this room, right? If I'm getting those, and I objectify the rest of the universe through those in a certain sense, right? So, you know, I realize that in order for the room to be this way, the universe must be that way. It sort of goes out from there. But I contain it all, right? So that's the sort of the unconditional quality of time is contained. Every actual occasion is an atom of time and space. But the relations between actual occasions, the causal relations, can be defined in different ways. Right? So for example, I'm right next to you in this room. Right? But I'm right next to my roommate, my stepfather, Stuart, in astral space. So we're contiguous in astral space, but not in waking space. Remember, I'm contiguous with you in waking space, right? And so there are different time spaces involved here, different time space relations. Each one of us contains the entirety of the past, but we organize the way we apprehend the past in different ways, right? We sort the past out into a causal order according to different principles, right? So time space has both of those functions, containment, which every actual occasion is an atom of space time. And then relationship, where there's some abstract structure determining intensity of causal objectification among occasions. Determining which one's next to which one affects which one gets affected first, which one gets affected second. Those are all part of the time-space relation. See what I'm saying? So there's the time-space as it functions imminently, and the time-space as it functions transiently. Right? With each actual occasion is an atom of time and space, contains the whole universe. But then there are structures of relationship between actual occasions which are geometrically defined. That's the other meaning of time-space, is that relational. So there's the imminent definition of time-space and the transient definition of time-space. I like these new words. That makes sense?
Eric, did you say you're right next to your roommate and your stepfather? Or
he's the same person. Same person. My roommate is my stepfather. And so he and I are very close, emotionally, right?
Your
and
astral roommate.
My real roommate is also my real roommate, my stepfather, Stuart.
You're right? Okay. I wasn't sure if you were talking, yeah.
My Stuart, right, is a human being, and he's somewhere in the East Bay, and yet I bet if something, if some accident were to happen to him, I would feel it in my body immediately. Because we're just like you and your guy who's overseas, right?
Brother, yeah.
We're emotionally close. So that means in the astral world, we're right next to each other, even though in the waking world, we're not. So there's a different geometry, a different structure of distance going on in the two worlds.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure if you were referring to somebody that
No, somebody alive I'm talking about. In this particular case.
But the waking world is something that's structured in our its appearance, and it's given the structure it has by, I could talk about in Cajuns, but the way the low and medium grade Cajuns...
I would say it's just an appearance, though. The waking world is not just an appearance.
No, it's real experience, right?
Yeah.
But it has a... It tends to have a structure that makes us believe that there's big hard things around.
Yeah.
And yet, through spiritual work, you can start to prehend a whole lot more.
That's right.
Than that.
That's right.
And then, aren't you kind of out of? I mean, space. I see. In your thing, space time is real here in some sense. Got geometry and so forth.
Whenever there are actual occasions, they're in community. And any community of actual occasions has to have some structure governing how they causally affect each other. And that is space-time.
Okay, so even transphysical things will have,
A space-time. That's right. Now, I'm claiming that the space-time of the transphysical can be described by metageometry. Yeah, last question, we gotta stop.
Are there any philosophers out there who have decided that all the current philosophies are inadequate to describe things having to do with like, the nature of time and that are working out new philosophies?
Not that I'm aware of. If you find one, I'd like to know. This is one of the questions. Last thing I'll say is I've noticed that everybody I'm studying has been dead for 50 years. So I'm curious what's going on in contemporary, what's happening now, right? So I don't know. But if you guys are reading contemporary people that you think are really interesting, let me know, because I'm looking before we find a source of information about that. Okay, everybody. Thank you. Now, here's what we're going to do. Next week, I will start out after our discussion section with a 45-minute or an hour lecture about Chapter 6. I'll cover. And then from this point on, it's all juicy. This is the end of the foundation. Now we actually get into transphysical world, transphysical psychology. It should get a lot juicier from this point forward. I really appreciate deeply the attention that you've been willing to give to establishing the foundation for our later conversation.